Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, it's war and rumors of war again today on the show. And as in the past, I'll remind this is not the end, nor beginning of the end, not even the end of the beginning of the beginning of the end, but merely the sound and fury of business as usual. That is not to diminish the horror and depravity of what we're seeing in Gaza and Lebanon and Yemen, and even more so the same for what is not being witnessed there and in all the elsewheres similar, but is meant only to emphasize the great work in front of us to bring finally a finish, for God's sake, to the global economic paradigm of perpetual warfare. The obstacles to that work are many, though, and they're arrayed and ready, waging war against the good with not only bullets and bombs, but with the pen and writs of law, too, arresting movements in the street and stoppering the mouths of those making media. Andy Worthington knows. He's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. He is too co-founder of both the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign and successfully completed We Stand With Shakir campaign. Andy's book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. His articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk, where he's inviting support of the effort to close Guantanamo. Andy Worthington in the first half. And as a Canadian, I'd like to say my country is at least doing its utmost to stay the terrible hand of its friends and allies, supporting and waging wars against the civilians of Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. But that would be untrue, just as it is a lie when the Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs, Melanie Joly, says that is the case. Sadly, Canada is up to its pointed elbows in war profiteering and the real politic of hard power in the aforementioned benighted locales, and in other places too. None perhaps know more about that than Canadian journalist and author and activist Eve Engler. Eve's written a baker's dozen of books about Canada and the perfidy of its foreign policy. His latest, co-authored with Owen Schock, is the recently released Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, described as a, quote, sweeping overview of Canadian-backed coups since 1950, documenting Canada's contribution to the ouster of over 20 elected governments, from Mohamed Mossadegh in Iran to Patrice Lumumba in Congo, Salvador Allende in Chile to Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti. Eve Engler confronting Canada's black action past and current dark actors in the second half. But first, Andy Worthington and singing the songs of Albion, that Britons be awakened. Welcome back to the show, Andy.
Thanks, Chris. Always lovely to talk to you.
Well, it's always my pleasure. Of course, you know that. Now, Andy, before getting to the calumny leveled against the forefathers by the perfidious Facebook, your friend and collaborator, Julian Assange, appeared yesterday to render testimony before the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, or PACE, regarding his ill treatment at the hands of British justice. Did you see any of that testimony?
I did, absolutely. I watched the whole thing. Did you watch it?
I did, yes, after the fact.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was very impressive. I think it was very good at somebody had told me, you know, about people who didn't like Julian Assange, and I'm thinking, you know, they're probably basing this on Julian as a younger man when he was probably sometimes very deliberately confrontational about his targets in the US. But yesterday, you know, we saw a much older man. We saw a man who's very clearly has been through something quite horrific. As he explained in his introduction, you know, trying to recover after 5 years of really quite horrible isolation in Belmarsh prison. You know, and I thought the context for that was very moving. And then I think in his testimony, he ran through the story of what WikiLeaks had been doing and how after the Obama years, when, you know, I thought it was interesting that he said Obama had wisely chosen, not to pursue him, and had also commuted Chelsea Manning's sentence. Under the Trump administration, suddenly things got really horrible, and particularly because of Mike Pompeo, then the director of the CIA, who behaved appallingly in the way that we know the CIA has behaved so often over the decades, in pursuing him so relentlessly, and you know, in these plans for his assassination, and you know, revealing how his wife was spied on 24/7, and this extraordinary story of how they were trying to extract DNA from his baby's nappy. So I thought that was very powerful. But I also thought he was very eloquent about the threat that was and still is posed to journalism by the United States, how he was a victim of that because he had perhaps thought that, well, he, as you said, he thought that the law should protect him. And it turned out that actually the law is manipulated by some of the dark forces that run this world when they feel like it. So, you know, I was very impressed with it. And also, you know, the moments when he touched on, some of this was in the questions and answers about the world that he has kind of properly emerged into, having had not that much contact with it for the last 5 years. And, you know, what an extraordinary world he's re-emerged into, where all of the problems that he highlighted with the mainstream media and with politicians before he lost his liberty have only been quite startlingly exacerbated, particularly over the last year. And, you know, I would say the timescale more accurately is kind of 2.5 years since the madness that greeted Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but particularly in the last year with the way that Israel's actions in Gaza and now seemingly the rest of the Middle East are beyond criticism in the eyes of most of the Western world's leaders still.
Well, certainly the media, which was never great, has been cowed to a level that it's hard to imagine. And I'm sure for him coming out, he's managed to follow some of it. But I mean, you know, it's very stark. I, you know, more properly, though, I when I was watching the Q&A session, as you mentioned, one of the questioners said, well, you know, to the effect, do you think it was worth it? And would you do it again? And his answer was very deliberate. And he spoke very deliberately and slowly, which, I mean, he always kind of did have that strange speaking style, but I found it to be more pronounced than I remembered. But he said, well, over these 14 years, it's been a very long time, and sort of reflecting on would I do this all again, because, of course, he was stuck in the embassy and under house arrest before being spirited off to Belmarsh and chucked into solitary confinement as well. What was your impression, having known him personally and having known him and worked with him so many years ago, contrasting the man you knew with the man you were seeing on the screen? I mean, yes, he was older and they were hard years, but what else did you take away from that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that, the perspective on, you know, would he have done it again? I mean, at the time, I only, you know, I knew him briefly around the time of the release of the Guantanamo files, which was in April 2011. At that point, he was under house arrest and, you know, and he was able to come to London to work on the release of these files with the journalists from all around the world. And, you know, we met in the offices of the Daily Telegraph, which had become his unlikely main British media partner at the time. And, you know, we went out and had meals and put the stories out there. But he was already a hunted man by that point. You know, and quite genuinely, you know, afraid at that point that you know, the CIA was already after him, that you know, he risked assassination. So I don't know that the, you know, and I think what also happened is that, you know, I'm not sure that he would have expected that he would be so fundamentally abandoned, certainly, you know, for a very long time by his mainstream media partners, who were just as culpable if there were any crimes that had taken place as he was. You know, this was about freedom of speech. This was about the First Amendment. This was about publishing and journalism. It wasn't about the leaking. The leaking was the source, presumably Chelsea Manning, of all of these files in the first place. And yet all these people who, you know, who cozied up to him, made money, took advantage, you know, they largely abandoned him when, you know, the axe came down and targeted him alone. So, you know, I think it's a long story of understanding, of trying to come to terms with, you know, was that huge loss of his life and of his presence in the field that he had devoted himself to, was it worthwhile? And, you know, and I suppose for those of us who've supported him, it was always reasonable to expect that they were going to come after him so horribly. What none of us knew was how it was going to manifest itself. There's certainly been times that, you know, many of us thought that he wouldn't live, and he certainly survived. I'm sure he's going to recover, and I think it's great to have him back. But I think he's recognized as well. When you go up against the huge machinery of state power, like the United States, and clearly like its you know, slavish supporter, the United Kingdom, they will come down really heavily on you, and that's what happened.
Well, it certainly put the lie to the idea of justice in Britain. They failed to meet the challenge of their own system, the system that was the paragon of places like Canada and the common law and so many other places as well. I know that when I found out, I mean, beyond the shock that finding out he was actually released, I felt a tinge of excitement that there would be another soldier in the field, and such a capable one at that, given, you know, the current context that you describe. Do you think it's fair to for me and for others to expect more out of him, or can we just say, okay, well, Julian, you know, you've done more than enough, and you can just take a break, take a rest, and leave the field? No?
Well, I mean, who knows, Chris? I mean, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, isn't it? What would you feel like if you'd lost, you know, so many years of your life? Would you, you know, and you were in your late 30s and now you're in your early 50s? Would you, yeah. How would you respond? I mean,
now he's a parent, too. He's had these two children, some of them miraculously in the interim.
And I mean, he clearly needs to enjoy his life, which I suspect in all of those years of WikiLeaks, you know, when they published all of these files and he became, of course, celeb, I'm pretty sure that wasn't a time that involved much, you know, peace and quiet and relaxation. So he's in a different place. But, you know, what I thought came across was his eloquence about, you know, the fundamental importance of journalism. You know, which was always such a clear-cut thing for him, if you like. So, you know, I would hope that he will still maintain a presence because, you know, as you and I know, Chris, there are many great voices out there, but we're, you know, they and us are almost entirely overwhelmed by the influence and the power of those who are supporting the things happening in the world, which, you know, in so many ways are worse than they've ever been before.
Well, he said markedly, Assange, that if he was guilty of anything, it was his naivete of believing that the judicial system and, as you mentioned, some of the people he had collaborated with would come to his support. Of course, he had loads of support from little people like you and I and legions of others, but his major media collaborators, of course, they ran for the hills immediately. The Guardian being probably the most shameful example that I can think of, only because the expectation of them is higher than someone like the Times or his German partners. I thought it was funny, though, he was talking about, well, I've got to get used to this new world, the electric cars and all that. But also this new understanding of what journalism is. As I said, it was always suspect, but now it just seems to be taken for granted that any so-called mainstream are just stenographing or stenographers rather to the powerful and repeating the yeah. messages of the powerful in every story. But also this so-called mainstream alternative news as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a, you know, it, while you were speaking then, I was thinking of a couple of things. One of them that I was thinking about was him talking about, you know, witnessing a live stream genocide like we all have been, which has taken journalism into a new kind of territory. And a positive one. I mean, I don't mean positive in the sense of what we're seeing, which is heartbreaking, but the very ability of people using phone technology to be able to report directly everything that's happening is so significant. And, you know, the final nail in the coffin, I think, for the old school reporting world, where it was always white saviors who were traveling around the rest of the world reporting from the front line. You know, the other side of how on earth would you come to terms with the world of the notorious online celebrities who've got followers in the millions, but who I think are all, you know, really quite dubious, these big names of the online world. At the least, I would say they seem indiscriminating in the way that they of who they choose to focus on, who they choose to interview. That right wingers are presented as though they're somehow cozy figures, and the lines between left and right are getting blurred somewhere behind the back of everything, where people that conspiracy theories, I think, have done a lot of that. They've kind of dissolved a lot of the differences that used to exist. I mean, I know people that, that had spent their lives being on a left that you and I understand, but who over the years have become marinated in conspiracies and are now consulting with the far right without even realizing it. You know, and this is a desperately treacherous media landscape over which we don't have any control. And I think Julian was alluding to that, you know, that there doesn't seem to be an easy way in to making the kind of difference that he had hoped to make in 2010 and 2011, and of course in many ways actually did.
And the attacks against media, and I mean the lawfare that's being practiced against, you know, most drastically against Julian Assange himself, but also against Britain's Richard Medhurst, and what we've seen, the activist and journalist, I don't know if she describes herself that way, but Sarah Wilkinson as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was talking to, I think it was David Rovix just the other day, and he was saying, yeah, it was David, and he was saying that not only did they do all those things that you hear about with Sarah Wilkinson, is tipping her mom's ashes, you know, off the mantle, and ransacking her house and stealing all her media, and arriving at her house with a huge goon squad of machine gun toting balaclava clad gangsters. But they also did something that the Americans do frequently, is they, I don't know what the police call this, I'm sure there's a word for it, but they put them handcuffed in the back of a van and then drive around sharp corners and stuff, banging the person in the back around like a pea in a can. They did this to the 60-something-year-old Sarah Wilkinson as well. Have you heard about that?
No, I hadn't heard about that bit about the van. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. It was an act of, you know, huge intimidation, I think, more than anything else. And based on, you know, a problem that needs to be tackled. You know, as so often in this country, we have brilliant human rights lawyers on the side of humanity, and I hope that they can push back. But this is all based around a handful of people that they allegedly targeted under terrorism legislation because, you know, one way or another, they had interpreted it that these people had expressed support in some way for Hamas, I think it would have been at the time, although Hezbollah would be another one that could happen now. And this is because our governments have wrongly labeled Hamas and Hezbollah as terrorist organizations, when actually what they are, as is so often the case with liberation movements, is that they're both a political entity with an administrative context and also with a military wing. And actually, Chris, I think it's so crucial, because what we've been looking at since October the 7th last year is how Israel has eroded the notion of any difference between a political Hamas, an administrative Hamas, and a military Hamas, and has been persistently using it to justify the indiscriminate slaughter of civilians in their tens of thousands with the support of the West.
Well, it reminds me, I mean, for the Brits, I'm sure it's very familiar, of the IRA and how there was never a delineation between Gerry Adams and the talking IRA and the military wing of that organization. It was all lumped into one thing, and that they were terrorists and that they couldn't be bargained with or anything, because you don't reward terrorism.
But, you know, as many Irish people have been pointing out over the last year, what you didn't see was the British government air bombing Belfast to total destruction, in the way that if they were to mm-hmm. be using the Israeli playbook now, that's what they would do.
Well, that might be next as well, or at least with these drones, these killer drones and such.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, those are so horrible, and very exportable technology, surely.
Well, indeed, they're all allies after all, aren't they? And they're all complicit as well. We talk about the Cyprus base being used to bomb Lebanon and Gaza, but the Article 12, is it Article 12? This the terrorism bill in the UK.
Yeah, that's right.
Article 12. Well, and aside from that, now, and what we were sensibly going to set up to talk about was what's happened with you and the other attack on Voices of Dissent. But before getting to that, remind everyone, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Andy Worthington. Andy's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Four Fathers Band. He's also a co-founder of the Close Guantanamo campaign and successfully completed We Stand With Shakir campaign. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prisons, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, The Battle of the Beanfield, and his articles appear at his website, andyworthington.co.uk. Look at me. I'm losing my voice just talking about your accomplishments, Andy, and I'm sure I'm not even getting to the documentary films and all the rest of it. Okay, so Andy, now the Four Fathers, tell our listeners who don't know, and I'll be playing some at the break, who the Four Fathers are and just what it is you're doing that's gotten up Facebook's nose.
Well, the Four Fathers is a band that I formed with some friends 10 years ago. I mainly write songs that are, political songs, protest songs, drawing on my love of both the politicized reggae scene and the punk scene of my youth, elements of Bob Dylan in there as well. And what happened was that one of the posts that mentioned the release of our new album, Songs of Loss and Resistance, was taken down by Facebook. That, as far as the band is concerned, that puts me in a position to say, we're the band that was banned. But actually, the issue of censorship on Facebook, which I've encountered over the last few months, is kind of much more sweeping than that. What happened was that back in July, so I've been on Facebook, for 15 years, and obviously anyone who's been on the site for that amount of time has learned that the rules have changed and you've had to dodge this and that. Certainly anyone dealing with the rights of the Palestinians has persistently had a problem on when it comes to Meta. Since October the 7th, I hadn't particularly noticed that I was being affected in any way. Until July, and this coincided with a time when Meta publicly announced that it was clamping down on the use of the word Zionism and on negative interpretations of Zionism being promoted. And I had three posts taken down linking to my website, which had not happened before, all on a spurious basis that they breached community standards on cybersecurity. Which, they're not even honest in saying why posts are being removed. And I'm absolutely certain that those posts were removed because of this huge ramping up of references to Israel and its genocide in Gaza. One of those posts was reinstated. I appealed. There's a very inadequate process of appealing, which I always try. I tried that, and only one of those posts was reinstated. I had no explanation. I never heard back from them about the others. That kind of died down, and I suspect that what happened was that they received a noticeable volume of complaints from people about how ridiculously punitive the regime had become. And then what happened just in September was that suddenly there was another wave of censorship, again on this spurious basis of cybersecurity, and three of my posts were removed again, two of them linking to my website, one which was, you know, hilariously promoting the release of a protest music album by my band. But more worryingly for me, the other was about monthly vigils for the closure of Guantanamo, which I set up in February last year and which I've been posting about with no problems. And they also removed a post from about 6 months ago that had appeared on my closed Guantanamo website. And, you know, as you will be able to appreciate, Chris, as somebody whose main work is about Guantanamo, if a censorship regime is introduced on Facebook, which prevents people from accessing my website, prevents me from posting about it, then that would be very shocking, because Guantanamo has for such a long time been a backwater. Censors don't really, you know, state and establishment censors don't really take that much interest in Guantanamo, because frankly, nobody cares about it. If there was suddenly a mass movement for the closure of Guantanamo, that would be a different matter. But I, you know, I don't know. That was it was pretty intense for a week or so, where everything I was publishing was being removed. And I thought, well, this is it. They finally shut me down completely. And of course, you know, as I would take screenshots and put these out, and then people were coming back to me, and I was getting vast amounts of reports from people about how, you know, other people on the left who were talking about politically contentious issues, you know, like Israel and Gaza, but, you know, other topics, were also having their posts removed. And, you know, and Facebook, as we know, is a completely unapproachable entity. There's no way to get through to them. So it seems to have died down again, Chris. But you know, I'm trying to contact people who work on these issues of you know, outrageous and unacceptable censorship on social media, to try and discuss this more fully, because you know, I'm sick, and so many other people are sick of this virtual police state that Facebook has established, and it's not the only social media company, where, you know, we're kind of picked off and disappeared randomly with no explanation provided. There are red lines that apparently we can't cross, but we don't know what they are. I mean, the whole thing is a you know, an insult to people who are just trying to share information freely that should be in the public domain.
Well, I'm sure Franz Kafka would be pleased, or horrified more likely, to know that he has transcended the century boundary and is firmly entrenched in the 21st century. But despite it all, Andy, your album with the Forefathers, Songs of Loss and Resistance, has managed to register on Bandcamp as a bestseller. Or is it because or despite of this interference, do you think?
No, I mean, it just, you know, to be honest, Chris, it's on there because it's in very niche
parts. the category.
Music, you know, which, you know, is not as popular as you might expect it to be in a world where there's so much to protest about.
So it's like the category of left-handed, red-headed dwarf a combo band.
Yeah,
you're the number one Cockney left-handed dwarf red-headed country music reggae band on Bandcamp. Well, that's great anyway. And people listening can go to Bandcamp and check out the Four Fathers. That's four, the number fathers, Songs of Loss and Resistance. Andy, we're going to cut it short so that I can play one of your tunes. You recommended I play All About Love. Do you want to tell me right. all about love, or a little bit about it?
Well, this is just an environmental song about the collapse of a livable planet, in which I take a very straightforward and naive old hippie message that love is more important than money.
one of your upbeat version offerings. Okay, Andy. Well, it's always a joy to speak with